Hello, everyone. Welcome to the TeamCast. I am Dr. Preston Klein, Director of Research and Education at the Mission Critical Team Institute. The TeamCast is a show where my colleagues, along with our guests, discuss all things Mission Critical Teams. Mission Critical Teams are teams of 4 to 12 people who are indigenously trained and educated and who solve rapidly emerging complex adaptive problem sets. MCTs work in immersive environments of 300 seconds or less, where the consequence of failure is death or catastrophic loss. Regardless of whether you are a mission critical team or not, we aim to bring you the broadest range of topics and guests as possible. Thanks for joining us, and I hope you enjoy the TeamCast.
Now, this is actually a really cool collaboration. This is a joint episode between Emergency Mind and the Mission Critical Team Institute. So maybe you're listening to this from the Emergency Mind podcast. Maybe you're listening to this from the Mission Critical TeamCast. Either way, we're happy to have you. It's going to be a fun conversation. Our guest this episode is Dr. Jeremy Cannon. Dr. Cannon is a professor of surgery at the University of Pennsylvania, where he serves as the surgeon champion for the Penn Medicine U.S. Navy Trauma Training Partnership, which is an awesome thing that we're going to dig a lot into. He's a graduate of the U.S. Air Force Academy and Harvard Medical School and holds a Master of Science in Mechanical Engineering from MIT. He served as president of the Excelsior Surgical Society from 2022 to 2023, and he recently edited Churchill's Surgeon to Soldiers 2024 edition. He has a focus on military health policy, and he's now serving as a veteran fellow in the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. Jeremy, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I have been really looking forward to this conversation. I've learned a ton from our prior ones, and I think folks here are going to learn a lot from this one. So thank you.
Thank you, Dan. It's such a pleasure to be here with you and looking forward to unpacking this really interesting topic, this topic that I spend a lot of my day and some of my nights thinking about. Just looking forward to the discussion.
Yeah. So we're going to do most of this episode around the interface of military medicine and around the idea of what it takes to get the, let's call it, for lack of a better term, until you teach me otherwise, the military medical complex up and running at the speed and strength that we need it to be. But before we go there, let's go back in time a little bit. What got you down this path? Like, when did you start thinking about being a doctor? When did you start thinking about the military? Were those questions entwined for you? And what's that path look like that got you to be here, where you have what's really a unique vantage point on the problem set that we're talking about?
Great question, Dan. My journey into the health profession started at the Air Force Academy. Like many who have aspirations to attend all of our military academies, but especially the Air Force Academy, we want to serve. That we often have a specific idea of what that service looks like. For me, it was in the cockpit of a fighter jet. It was maybe a test pilot. Certainly, there was a heavy dose of Top Gun in there. All of that changed on about the third day of basic training when I developed a pneumomediastinum, had a small spontaneous pneumothorax. And now looking back at that and talking with others in the medical field, about 3 to 5 cadets every year have this problem.
No kidding.
I'm not very tall, but others that have this problem are tall, a typical demographic, and they see this pretty commonly. For me, it really changed my trajectory. I started thinking seriously about other career fields. I never once thought that I would leave the academy. I had just worked so hard to get there.
Yeah.
There was no way I was leaving, and I really did want to serve. I also, you know, just appreciated the rigors, the discipline, and I didn't at the time know that there was an opportunity to progress into the medical field, but I thought if there were, it would be a good fit.
Okay. If you're listening to this and you're not medical, this is a crazy story that Jeremy has just told, right? So it's basically saying that he had a spontaneous rupture of one of his lungs that drifted air into his chest and then around his heart, which is painful, complicated, and unfortunate. And so that's the kind of a hell of a thing to happen on the third day of training. And it's great that it didn't derail you from moving in that direction and opened up a bunch of possibilities. It's always fun looking back on the things that nudge us into one path or another. And you think about the integral of your life over time and what you accomplish with it and how that integral would have changed if various little things had been different in there. Now, okay, so you got into medicine, and why surgery? And specifically, like, why surgery in this way that you're doing it?
Another very interesting story. Families mean a lot. And in this case, my future relative by marriage, my sister's husband's father was an anesthesiologist in our hometown, my hometown, Springfield, Missouri. And on a break from my studies at the Air Force Academy, he very generously offered to have me shadow in his hospital. So I had known this man for many years. He was a pillar in our community. His children were just ever present in the school on all the sports teams, just such a great father figure and a wonderful human being. And he very generously brought me into the hospital. And I still remember the first time I ever saw a patient intubated. It was the most brutal thing. And if I had not known how generous and kind this man was, I would have thought, man, he really must hate this person because he's doing a number on their mouth. Like, it was a little shocking. And then, so I got past that shock and awe, and he generously brought me into the operating room where they were doing open heart surgery. And the minute I encountered the subculture of the operating room, the very elegant, seemingly choreographed dance between the surgeon's assistant, the technician or nurse handing instruments, and just the beauty of the technical facility of the operation, the flow of the operation, the smell of the operating room, it just clicked for me. And I knew that I was in my happy place with my people. They didn't know that yet. So it took a while for them to be convinced that I was a surgeon in the making. But I still remember that first operation, just how seemingly miraculous it was. Just the wonder of being in the operating room was so compelling. I knew I had to be there.
That feeling of just clicking in place, like you can't really say why, but this is home. This is where, you know, you're shaped to make a difference. That what a feeling. Like, what a cool space. I have this very distinct memory. I actually don't even remember if it was on my trauma surgery rotation or my orthopedics rotation, but I kept wanting to go down to the ER. And trauma surgeons and orthopedists, they don't necessarily like the ER. So they're like, why does this kid want to go down to the ER all the time? And I'm like, I don't know. I got to be there. I got to see what they're doing. I got to know what's going on. And it's 3 a.m. and I'm walking through the halls of Boston Medical Center, trying to figure out how to even get down to the ER. And I'm like, this is it. I know this is where I need to be. That excitement and joy about it is pretty massive.
I had a similar experience on my pediatrics rotation. We somehow ended up with a child that had pyloric stenosis. And of course, that typically requires a surgical intervention where you divide the pyloric muscle. And I just could not detach myself from the child as the ward nurse took the baby down to the operating room. I still remember encountering the pediatric surgical fellow, Carrie Buckmiller, as she strode into the pre-op area with just such confidence. I'm like, this woman just is on the top of her game, and I want to be like that. And then just seeing the incredible outcome that patient had, it was just transformative. They went from, the medical team was really struggling to do their absolute best to fix all the abnormal electrolytes and to provide support for the child. But it was only the surgical intervention that really transformed the trajectory. Again, just another reaffirming moment in my journey into surgery.
I love it. And we're gathering the threads here, right? We're gathering the threads of understanding that scope of competence and expertise and what it takes to lead a team in that moment. Because these threads are going to turn into the weave of our conversation around the 100K project and the peacetime effect in just a minute as we get to that. But we're almost there. Okay, surgery in that direction. And then take me the rest of the way there. Take me through service. Take me through getting into health policy. Military policy. Take me into that space. What's the next step of that journey there?
So Dan, I trained in Boston and was really just so blessed to be in that incubator in the intense academic environment there, and inspired by many great basic scientists, clinical researchers, clinicians, and just felt like I was very well grounded in all aspects of surgery, but I hadn't fully fallen in love with trauma yet. And I finished up my training in Boston, including a research fellowship at Boston Children's in their cardiac surgery department, with my research mentor, Pedro Del Nido, and then a clinical fellowship in surgical critical care. I was going to be a pediatric surgeon. And after that experience I described, I think you could understand why. But Uncle Sam doesn't need a lot of pediatric surgeons on the active duty military roster. And it turns out, like my pneumomediastinum experience at the Air Force Academy, I really think things happen for a reason. And I discovered my why and more of my happy place during my first deployment. So I finished up all my training in Boston, made my way to my first active duty assignment in San Antonio at Wilford Hall at the time, before it had merged with the Army. And then shortly thereafter, found myself in Iraq as a member of this incredible team of, in many cases, combat experienced surgeons, nurses, emergency medicine physicians, laboratory specialists, blood bankers, radiologists, and in a tent hospital in Balad, Iraq, I absolutely fell in love with all aspects of trauma. The preconceived notions about what trauma surgery was all about, the difficult problems that trauma surgeons and patients face every day really came into clear focus. So my preconceived notions were washed away. The challenges that I knew would occupy and stimulate my mind for years, if not decades to come, really became clear. So it was that amazing deployment experience. Sold me on trauma surgery, and then I've been blessed to be in a place where I could lead and progressively get into leadership positions, including trauma medical director at the DoD's Level 1 Trauma Center in San Antonio. And then I finished up my active duty service time in 2015. I made my way to Philadelphia, where I currently practice trauma surgery at the University of Pennsylvania. So that transition then leads to my interest in military health policy.
Can you, for folks that aren't as experienced with the way military medicine works, can you talk a little more about what your team structure was like in that hospital in Iraq? And maybe this is a conversation about the different roles that we have, or maybe this is a conversation about who it is that's there, because I think that's going to lead us to this point about how do we get people trained the right way to be in the spaces that they're in.
It's a fascinating story. This is really the first conflict where we, on the U.S. side, had the ability to establish a trauma system for the combat theater. And I think many of us in the United States take our very robust and exceptional healthcare system a little bit for granted.
Sure.
And over the past several decades, combat experienced physicians from Vietnam came back and said, I could get better care where I was in Vietnam than my family gets here in the United States when it comes to trauma care. And through very deliberate and persistent efforts, those visionary surgeons established the fledgling trauma system that is still in evolution and still in development. We don't actually have a national trauma system, but at the local and in some instances, the regional level, we do have a robust system of care to get the right patient to the right place in the right amount of time in most places across the United States. We had nothing like that in our combat theaters of, at the time, both Afghanistan and Iraq. And around 2004, John Holcomb, Don Jenkins, and many other really visionary military trauma surgeons said, we've got this great system, particularly in South Texas, around Wilford Hall and Brooke Army Medical Center, that brings acutely injured patients to military hospitals and to university hospital in San Antonio. Why can't we have something like that in Iraq and Afghanistan? And they started laying the foundation for that system of care. And that was superimposed on the concept of casualty evacuation that we've adhered to for many decades. If you look back at historic documents from World War II, you mentioned I had edited this book originally by Edward Churchill, who was a important leader in our allied medical forces in World War II. He has a map of this casualty evacuation sort of chain. And we had something like that, but it was not infused with the wisdom and the safety nets and the sort of performance improvement ethos of the trauma system that we have in the United States. But merging those two, you have an outstanding system of care that can get an injured casualty from most places within the combat theater to the right place for definitive surgical care, hemostasis, and then evacuation to the next level of care. And for these conflicts, of course, it was Longstuhl and then back to the U.S. I entered this first deployment 2007 into a system that was had been pretty well established, but this was the first time such a system had ever been established in a combat theater, an actual no kidding trauma system on top of this chain of evacuation concept.
Who was with you in the team that you were operating with in that space? And what were their backgrounds like? What was that special sauce like? Because I think on the civilian side, we talk all the time about how functioning trauma systems are multidisciplinary and multiprofessional teams that are mixed, right? You have the ER tribe, the ICU tribe, the surgery tribe, doctors, nurses, PAs, all of the OTPT allied everything around it. And we think about them as these massive systems, and more or less we've mapped the pipelines of what it takes to get people into it if we're talking about Boston Children's and who shows up at that kind of thing. But the structure is a little different when we're talking about this hospital that you were operating in. So what does that look like?
I would say it's a little different in that you're living together and working together all in very close proximity. You do a trauma resuscitation earlier in the morning, and then you go have lunch with your team and all the members of the team. If you're a jerk or short-tempered or just difficult to get along with, it's going to affect your team very immediately, and I think very, very problematically. It's a real challenge. It really does tend to knock off some of the rough edges, and your personality will show through, but hopefully it's in the spirit of being collaborative and keeping, as we always try to do, the patient at the center. But you're in such close proximity, like your living quarters, you're in a small little neighborhood. You already mentioned you're going to the dining facility with your colleagues, and it just, you get along much better if you're easygoing.
Yeah.
Now, was I always easygoing? I feel like I still had a little bit of that prickliness, and subsequently got some independent feedback that I was a little prickly, but I learned from that, and I tried to just take it down a notch or 10.
That is spoken with wisdom of time past right there, I'm sure. Yeah, we used to have this thing at Mass General called family meal, right? And it was always 9 o'clock, and everybody that was around, every resident that was around, a lot of the attendings too, would come down to the cafeteria, and if they could get away for a moment and have food together. And it was more problems between systems got solved at family meal than any official meeting or any official anything about it. And it was just such a beautiful system. And man, I have a lot of good memories from that time over the years of residency. But okay, so we're talking about how there's this back and forth learning process between military medicine and civilian trauma care. And we see how it goes from with the folks coming back from Vietnam and setting up the trauma systems here. And now in some ways, we're actually asking it to go the other direction, right? We're asking civilian healthcare and especially civilian trauma care to step up and do more for our military brothers and sisters. And I think we're at the point now where we've danced around this a lot, and we can get into this concept of what is Project 100K? What is the peacetime effect? And why is that something that we all need to be paying attention to, we all need to be working on, and that we need to be actively addressing?
I'm so happy that you asked me to talk about this leading up to this conversation. I've called this Project 100K for a couple of reasons. First reason, we've lost in the last 80 plus years, approximately 100,000 service members, because our military medical system was not ready for the next conflict that we got embroiled in. Our medical units went off very faithfully doing their duty to the conflict, but did not have the shared mental model, the concept of what looked like systems, and the logistics were not in place to ensure that every service member with a survivable injury made it back home alive. And if you look at World War II, Korea, Vietnam, and then even OIF and OEF, and compare the survivability of combat wounds for those that had more than just a flesh wound, it's on the order of 100,000 service members, 107,000 to be exact, that we believe could have been saved if we had just maintained the quality of care that we achieved in the previous conflict. So going back to World War II, if we had only maintained the case fatality rate from World War I, come on, World War I, surely it, by World War II, we could do better than we did in World War I, right? It turns out a lot changes in just a few years. The weapons are more destructive. The fighting tactics may have changed a little bit. The defensive weapons, body armor, helmets may not be up to the task. And we know that offensive and defensive weapons really evolve in parallel throughout history. They evolve in parallel, that you're only like one step ahead of the next innovation, or a half step even. So if your military medical system is not super sharp, cutting edge, and your team members are not gelled together and sharing that framework of how to do this well for the individual patient, and then as a system, how to ensure that we have patients going to the right facility, have patients evacuated at the right time, intervening with things like tourniquets and whole blood. If we've lost those lessons and that experience, if we're not applying best practice on day one, we absolutely will lose service members with survivable injuries. And we've seen that in our modeling from the beginning of World War II through the modern era, OIF and OEF, 100,000 service members. And that's roughly one in four that could have been saved. Fast forward, Brian Eastridge has done work looking at potentially preventable or potentially survivable outcomes. So potentially preventable death, potentially survivable injuries. His work shows it's about one in four, even in Iraq and Afghanistan. When we really take a critical, inward-facing, deep dive into what happened, what was the cause of death, what led up to that, it's about one in four. We have to do better. We have to flatten that curve, shift the curve, change the paradigm. The 100,000 combat casualty losses that I'm looking at generally are from a very steep learning curve. It's interesting that the learning curve in World War II was very steep, very steep. Our casualty case fatality rate was extraordinarily high at the beginning of World War II. It got better. Thankfully, it got better. And then interestingly, between World War II and Korea, there was a fairly short interval. And a lot of the medical teams that went to Korea in that first wave had been experienced on the battlefields of World War II. So there was a little bit of a learning curve, but actually not too bad. So our losses from Korea, although the numbers are pretty high, it's because the casualty numbers were extraordinarily high early on in that conflict. Our outcomes relative to what they had been at the end of World War II were pretty good. Now, could we have done better in terms of logistics and rather than just rushing headlong into this? Yes, but you don't always have that luxury. But if you then go to Vietnam, it's like absolutely atrocious. It is horrific. And nobody's actually really unpacked these statistics until our team did, because they're on punch cards or the equivalent in the National Archives. And that story has never actually been written. There's no Surgeon General's history of Vietnam because we never declared war. There are no resources behind
Interesting.
Putting these statistics together to tell the story. We've done a little bit. I feel like we've just scratched the surface, but the outcomes are really terrible at the beginning. Thankfully, the casualty numbers were not enormous, but for those that were injured, your chance of making it back were not great. Mm. It got better for many years in the middle portion of that conflict. We did better. We had systems in place. We had experienced surgeons like Basil Pruitt in the theater. But then at the end, we lost our way. It's like we had combat fatigue and our case fatality rate really jumped up again. And then at the beginning of Iraq and Afghanistan, we see yet again, this very steep learning curve at the beginning, no trauma system in place. We pretty much had air superiority, maybe even air supremacy from pretty early on, maybe throughout, but we didn't have the system and the network and the nodes and the right people in the right place at the right time all sorted out just yet. It costs lives, undoubtedly. So that's how I get to 100,000. On the how many have we lost in. The other side of that coin is through projections and modeling and work by the National Disaster Management System pilot study, NDMS pilot. We're hopefully worst case scenario, but nevertheless, it's an important number to keep in mind, projecting the possibility of 1,000 casualties per day for 100 days. Pretty easy math, 100,000 casualties. So interesting how those two numbers line up. I keep that number in mind because it's, for me, an easy number to remember, but it's also a good memory hook for, well, how are we actually going to care for all those casualties? And how many will not survive because the system is unprepared? You don't know. But my hope and my goal and my purpose in much of what I do is to ensure that as many casualties as have survivable injuries will actually make it. And will not just make it by the skin of their teeth, live their best life afterwards. So to achieve that end, we've got a lot of work to do, but with great collaborators like you and many others, hopefully we can get there.
Oof. Jeremy, thank you for what you're working on and for laying that out like that. I think if you're listening to this and you've spent time around suffering or death like that, how much of an impact even a fraction of those numbers have in families and communities and society. And the thought, I think for any doctor, the thought that there are lives lost because of learning curves is a humbling to border on terrifying thought. I think that's a huge charge for all of us as a society to address that. We're talking here in the forward projection space about this, about what it would look like if we were involved again in a LISCO event, large-scale combat operation event. And there are many reasons why we don't want that on anybody's side. And we want to keep peace. And we also prepare for what happens if that's not the case. And the idea here, just to put a name to it, that you've been sharing with me outside of this, that learning curve, we sometimes want to call the peacetime effect, right? Because this is the idea that when we are in peace, when we are blessed with peace, right, our systems are not as sharp and as put together as they are when we're at war. And as a result, that dip that you're describing, that learning curve happens again. And it's interesting as we're talking about this, that there's a couple of factors that seem to boil into that, right? So you talk about the knowledge and the knowledge changing. That's certainly part of it, right? The types of injury patterns we see change, the trauma changes, the systems we have available change. So there's a knowledge component to it. There's the small group team component to it, right? We have to get that teams actually gelled and ready to go. There's the systems component. We have to deploy both. We have to deploy supply chains of getting the right stuff to the right places. We have to move people from their point of injury to their point of definitive care. Some of this is a forward deploying problem, tourniquets and whole blood and the knowledge of how to use those things as far forward as possible. And then what else is in there, right? When you look at this structure that you want to build to try to address this, and we have this challenge of not again hitting 100K, right? Not again hitting those lives lost to a steep learning curve. What does that look like?
Yeah, Dan, that is the $100 million question. There's a center at Stanford called the Gordian Knot Center. The Gordian Knot can only be resolved by cutting the rope in half. It's a perfect analogy for this kind of problem. Another way people think about it is the concept of a wicked problem. Having spent time in Boston, and even if you haven't lived in Boston, you may have seen Good Will Hunting. He was wicked smart. So yeah, this concept of wicked being and adjective is out there. So a wicked problem is enormous. It's intractable. There's no easy solution. Even if you make headway on it, it might come back if you're not constantly attending to it. It's like my neurosurgical colleague, Jim Schuster, says, rust never sleeps. So it takes constant attention. So what is it that contributes and how can we start to think about solutions to this Gordian knot or wicked problem? I think certainly you have to have the right ingredients. So it's the team that consists of individuals that are really at the top of their game, the truly trauma experts, whether it's the point of injury medic or the transport team bringing that patient to the first point of care, the resuscitation team consisting of physician assistants, nurse practitioners, emergency medicine physicians, surgeons in the military, sometimes even medical specialists that are at that initial resuscitation. And all of those individuals need to not have trauma as a hobby, but somehow need to have what right looks like imprinted on their professional selves, like their concept of what it takes to gel as a team, to get the patient from A to B to C in the right order, not skipping over parts that are when they need to be addressed. So the framework of ATLS, of airway, breathing, circulation, with a military twist. So X, meaning exsanguinating hemorrhage, you deal with that first, and then you get to the ABCs, and just everyone being on the same page. That does not happen by accident. At the University of Pennsylvania, we've got a great partnership with the U.S. Navy, where we have active duty trauma teams that are not just here for finishing school just in time training, but they're fully immersed with us. They're practicing in their home units, we call it. We have an ICU nurse that's on staff in our ICU. We have an anesthesiologist who works in our OR, but on Wednesdays, they all come together and they are our resuscitation team. We call it Navy Wednesdays. And then we're now having Navy Nights. So, you know, the Navy team comes together. And the first step, of course, is to learn your primary role, who's doing the primary and secondary survey, who is the team leader. And then as we move along through the year, we get to cross-training. Can that medic serve in the role like in the nurse's role or in the primary proceduralist role to put in a chest tube or to under supervision do things that they wouldn't normally do in their practice? So really to make sure that they're practicing at the top of their license and then understand everyone else's job and may even in a pinch do that job if, heaven forbid, that team member is not available in capacity or what have you. So it really starts with an excellent team. You also mentioned logistics, and then you also mentioned lessons learned. A lot to unpack there, and happy to go in whatever direction you want to take this.
Yeah, it's interesting. So that model is really important, and there's a couple different models of military-civilian partnerships that are ongoing at the moment that we're trying. So there's the embedded team, like what you're describing, where it's a coherent team that embeds for a period of time. And then there's, as you described, the more finishing school approach, where folks who are going to medical roles in a deployment will often rotate through a particular trauma center for a period of time. We have folks like that at LA County, now LA General Hospital, that were awesome to get the chance to work with. But that is more of a finishing school. They're there for a short period of time, and then they go on to their space, and they might or might not be going with any of the other people that they're like co-localized with. Are there other models of those partnerships that I don't know about?
I think there are more organic models where, say, you're a general surgeon and you see a clinic at a civilian hospital and do cases at that hospital. So just more day-to-day practice. And then I would say there are also models for graduate medical education, where we have very deliberately embedded military surgical residents, for example, into specific training programs funded by the DOD. And we're looking at maybe even extending these key collaborative sites to include undergraduate medical education. Yeah. Do you steer folks that have earned or been awarded an HPSP scholarship to specific known and vetted schools that have the wherewithal and the will to provide some sort of a military-specific curriculum? I had none of that. I think I would have greatly benefited from it. And so I'm thinking that we can do even better than we did on day one, or at our very best at Iraq and Afghanistan. Why do we have to just do as good?
Yeah.
We can do even better if we're planning for and preparing and being very deliberate about both UMB and GME. And then once you're in practice, ensuring that you have a robust clinical practice, that you're professionally satisfied and working at the top of your license, at the top of your game, doing all the things that you were trained to do, and then able to come together when needed as a team, and you're all sharing that same mental model, what it looks like.
So I'm going to ask a question that's admittedly probably overly reductionist, and I doubt that the answer to this is going to be a simple one, but if what we need is more military-civilian partnerships where there are embedded teams in active trauma centers, why don't we have that? Is that a willpower problem? We don't want to do that for some reason. Is it a knowledge problem? Like we don't know how to do that for some reason. Is it a technology problem? There's some sort of difference in the way that systems operate in those two fields. Like there are many of all of those types of problems in medicine, and I could see it being any of those. I could also see it being what we have so often in medicine, which is I don't know if this is a subset of a wicked problem or not, but just like a freaking dumb problem where somebody's designed a square thing and somebody's designed a round thing, and there's just, you just have to tape them together for it to work, right? Like that happens in medicine literally constantly. So why do we have this problem? What is it?
Dan, I think you have to look to history of both our profession, medicine, and probably also the military as well. Why did our system evolve into this little bit of a Rube Goldberg contraption? We needs duct tape and baling wire. And is that really the best system? As Donald Rumsfeld says, you said you go to war with the army you have, maybe not the army you want. So I think we've typically gone to war with the military health system that we had. And maybe at some time we thought that's the system we wanted and needed, but maybe not. I think I mentioned the history of our profession. Medicine has become very specialized. So in the year 2025 is, I say, a surgeon who does primarily, let's say, reconstructive surgery, cosmetic surgery. Their practice has evolved to that. They did a residency or fellowship in plastic surgery. Are they the best qualified to do a damage control laparotomy? Maybe they did that once or twice in residency, but their entire professional focus has been on being the best reconstructive surgeon they can be. And to their credit, we really need those skills. But it then becomes a square peg and a round hole problem when you're in the midst of a hot conflict and you've got casualties that need exploratory laparotomy and mobilization of the vena cava and repair of that critical injury and maybe shunting an iliac artery and maybe doing a splenectomy and a distal pancreatectomy. Like those are procedures that maybe 30 or 50 years ago, residents did a ton of, and maybe in your practice, you would do a few of them and would be pretty facile with them. But I can tell you that today we're not getting those types of cases routinely in surgical residency. And then our practice of medicine has evolved such that we're not getting those, very few surgeons actually do those sort of cases. How do you concentrate your training so that you can have individuals that are proficient at doing that, your general surgeons, and then you have a few trauma surgeons that can be the captains of the team or the coaches and the mentors. So I think that's really the reality that we've now recognized. And how do we build a safe system around that? So I think part of it is, did we always have the best team we could have had? It's hard to say. You'd have to reconstruct a lot of the archives from Vietnam and Korea and World War II. And I think we had very good teams there. But at the same time, medicine has since evolved, and now we have to just deal with the realities of that evolution. I think this is a great way to deal with it.
I think we're also seeing in medicine a question of who we are and who we want to be. And I think that's really changing. And the problems that people are showing up wanting to solve are different than the problems that I showed up wanting to solve. And I'm sure they're different than the folks before me showed up wanting to solve. And some of that is natural progression over time, right? Like technology moves, medicine changes, the way we practice medicine changes. It's good. We rarely use leeches anymore, right? Although sometimes we use leeches, but still rarely compared to what we used to do. Although I have a very distinct memory from trying to obtain a leech as an intern for some reason. But in any case, like that's still pretty rare. But I think I know we're seeing this in emergency medicine where we're seeing a question of who are we? What is our role, right? And there are subsets of folks who are in emergency medicine who view emergency medicine almost as an arm of public health and as an arm of the social determinants of health, right? Emergency medicine that works on homelessness and addiction and access to food, all of which are incredibly important. Nothing I'm about to say is going to change the fact that those are important and we need smart people and smart teams working on. But the type of structure of team and maybe the type of structure of human that wants to go towards that type of a project is a little different than the one that wants to run into a complex, undifferentiated patient's room, lay hands on the patient, and get to work putting them back together again. And I know surgery feels that. I know medicine feels that. I know ICU feels that. But we're seeing this splintering of what our role is and the care that we're describing. There are some people in anesthesia, some people in surgery, some people in pediatrics, some people in ICU, some people in medicine, some people in ER, but there's no one thing that does it. And I don't know what the end of that sentence is, except that I see it playing out all the time, and I see it as a growing problem as opposed to a shrinking problem.
Dan, I think you got your finger right on the root of the challenge. And the question is, how do we rise to the challenge and meet that in a way that ensures our national security, that instills a lot of confidence in our volunteer warfighters, our service members that so faithfully put their own lives at risk to secure our freedom. Looking back at World War II, I just have such admiration for that generation and what they did. I think we can learn something of what it takes to survive and even be successful on the battlefield, even in the modern era. And I've come up with the concept of, and have many collaborators that have been promoting this concept of, the expeditionary physician, expeditionary surgeon, expeditionary medical specialist, expeditionary team member. And if you look at going into that undifferentiated space, you need someone who is in love with being a generalist and hopefully is very good at many things. It's hard to be exceptional at everything, impossible in fact. But if you focus your mind and your clinical practice and your hobbies around what it means to be an expeditionary physician, perhaps we'll have a core cadre of folks that can help us be successful. And Edward Churchill, I'll say in an unqualified fashion, was a prototypical expeditionary surgeon. He started out as an ivory tower academic, but after 2.5 years of hardship, of being on the front lines, of being in the trenches, literally with his surgeons, his infectious disease specialists, his nurses, his medical specialists, he evolved into that expeditionary surgeon. And I think if we can capture some of that and somehow promote that it in some fashion, we've had preliminary discussions with, say, the American Board of Surgery, some thought experiments with individuals that recognize this challenge. And it hasn't materialized, but I'm hopeful that we can make some headway there.
I love it. Jeremy, thank you so much for coming on the podcast, for digging into these issues, and for helping us all poke at this thing that needs to be poked at, for lack of a better word. As we wrap up here, folks that are listening to this who are inspired and who want to make a difference in this space, what do they do? How do they get involved? What's the way to send them, other than practicing their own skills and working on their own teams, which is, of course, part of the answer?
Fantastic question, Dan. I really could not have predicted that I would be interested in health policy, but I mentioned that I transitioned my practice from an active duty environment to the reserves as I moved in 2015 from San Antonio to Philadelphia. And my final reserve assignment was at Defense Health Headquarters. And there I saw where, you know, the levers are being pulled, where the sauce is being mixed. And it is vitally important. It's not often glamorous. Many of these faithful public servants are working behind the scenes, but it is so important to ensuring that the systems that we believe are the correct systems of care remain in place and are well supported. And that's all through policy. So I had an opportunity to undertake a policy fellowship at the Hoover Institution, Stanford University, and it's specifically a veteran fellowship. And it's for 10 military veterans that have a big, hairy, audacious project they'd like to sink their teeth into. And for me, that's been the peacetime effect. And I've felt so supported through this experience. And I hope that through my time at Defense Health Headquarters, and now with this more focused educational experience at the Hoover Institution, that I'll be able to make a headway on the policy gaps that we've identified. So I would encourage those that are motivated to sink their teeth into this problem, think about policy, or think about expeditionary surgery, or think about trauma or critical care, or think about mentoring a medical student that is on an HPSP scholarship that has never thought about what it's like to deliver care on the battlefield.
Love it. Love it. Thank you. So if you're listening to this from the emergency mind side, from the mission critical side, if you are on the military side or the civilian side in the US or within the allied sphere that we work with, thank you for listening to this and for working on the problems here with us. If you want to learn more about any of this, you could reach out to me directly, dan@emergencymind.com, or also dan@missioncti.com if you want to go that way with it. In any case, Jeremy, thank you so much for coming on the podcast, for talking about all this with us. It is an honor to have you.
It's really been a privilege. Thank you, Dan.
Thank you again for listening to our Teamcast. For more information about the Mission Critical Team Institute, please go to www.missioncti.com or follow us on LinkedIn or Instagram. If you are a Mission Critical Team that wants more information on our courses, please reach out to our Director of Operations, Janice Jackson, at janice@missionCTI.com. That's J-A-N-E-S-E @missionCTI.com. And once again, thank you, Janice, and thank you to Shelby Rowe Productions for helping us produce the Teamcast. Have a great day.